Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org. Talk about anxiety and worry today. The Buddha, I think really his mission in life was to help other people and to help them relieve what we sometimes call suffering in our tradition. You know, the first noble truth is life is suffering. At least that's the way it's translated. Very pithy and nice. Nice in its brevity, but maybe not a perfect translation. The Buddha identified our human basic problem as dukkha. That's the word that's translated into suffering. That's our basic trouble at the bottom of it. And dukkha literally means do is bad, and ka is the word for space or a hole in something. That's what I understand. So that hole apparently refers to the hole in a wheel. So when the hole in a wheel in the old days was bad, then you got a bumpy ride. So it's this subtle problem. It's not so, like, suffering in that way doesn't work quite so well. It's not the whoa, whoa, whoa is me. It's something more subtle. That's off, that's a problem, that's giving us a rough ride in life. So there is this, sometimes it's translated as unease, you know, or unsatisfactoriness. So life is marked by unsatisfactoriness or unease with some regularity. On a beautiful day like this, it's hard to explain to my daughter that life is suffering. But to tell, as I did this morning, what you're talking about? Oh, okay. So, but I do think that I can very easily make the case that life is marked by unease. A kind of unease, subtle. And, you know, traditionally, this is not from Zen texts, this is from Sanskrit and Pali texts. But traditionally, there are three kinds of dukkha, and I find them kind of interesting. I'm not going to go into them in detail. But the first one is dukkha-dukkha, which is just plain old-fashioned painful experiences in life, either physical or mental. The second one is virpanama. Upanima, dukkha, the dukkha of impermanence, of the changing nature of things, in particular, things going badly, things changing for the worse, and the kind of frustration and pain that that causes. And then the last one, Sankhara Dukkha, and I'd really like to read more about this. I've read some, but that's the most subtle ones. I think it goes from the gross to the fine. And that's sometimes referred to as the Dukkha of conditioned experience. And the way I understand it is that it's the unease that comes from realizing on a subtle level that those things, that everything is changing. Not thinking specifically about, oh, I want this good thing and you know, it might go away. But a very subtle, pervasive hum, maybe, that everything is subject to change, both good things and bad things. But that, in a way, it's, to me, it says, ultimately, we can't control as many things as we think we can. And that that's in the background, even though it may seem like we can. And that leads me to today's subject, which is anxiety. I'm not a doctor, and so I'm not really talking about anxiety in the medical way. I'm not a psychologist, but I'm just talking about anxiety and worry in the garden variety that we all feel from time to time and sometimes feel intensely. I think anxiety and worry tend us toward the future. Reading the Wikipedia article, of course, as I did, on anxiety. You know, fear is it can come in all different kind of forms. Anxiety is specific to the future, fearing something happening in the future. So it's clearly, in my view, related to change, to impermanence, to the fact that things might go south. And that's the thing that Buddha identified in the last two of these. You know, those three kinds of dukkha, the last two of them are really connected, tied in with this, with change, with impermanence as the problem. Yeah. So I think anxiety is a kind of a like clearly linked to this basic problem. But before I launch into a cure for anxiety and worry, I want to praise them a little bit. They are all honorable. They're both honorable emotions, I think. I just saw Julius Caesar last weekend. They are all honorable men. That's about... That speech is from Mark Antony, who says, Brutus and all the others, they're all honorable men. They did it, but the subtext is, you know, they went too far. They shouldn't have killed Caesar. But they're all honorable men in and of themselves. And I think that worry, as a for instance, is good and useful. Robert Wright, in his book on Why Buddhism is True, you know, he just came to speak. Talks about how, you know, as a species, we need worry. We need to be anxious at times. If we hear a sound that sounds like a rattlesnake, best that we jump and get out of the way of that. And that serves the purpose of getting our genes into the next generation by not getting bitten by a rattlesnake. And if we have to do that 99 times, 99 times it's not a rattlesnake, well then, that's the way we're built, to get out of the way. Which is maybe good for that purpose of getting the genes into the next generation, but it has other consequences, which can be problematic. Still, we live in a world, and I think I always like to emphasize this point, I often like to, that we need to care about outcomes, you and I. It's not as if this practice, I don't want this practice to lead you to think, oh, it's going to be okay, everything will be fine, no matter what. I don't want you to think that permanently. I do want you to think it temporarily, in a way. We'll get to that. But the fact is, we live in a world, and we need to part of living is to care, is to worry. And, you know, I think worry and stress are part of our lives and will be as long as we're living. And we shouldn't try to think otherwise. I remember my teacher, you know, one time, how is it going, Roshi? Yeah, very tired. I spent last night, couldn't sleep last night, worrying. Worrying about my students, he said. So that's a form of worry. You know, there he is. That told me early on, oh, yeah, worry. Okay, that's part of life. That's part of his life. That's part of everybody's life. But of course, they can become unhelpful habits. And I think that we humans, as you know, uniquely self-reflective beings, that have created a culture, a life that is complex, ever more complex, we're uniquely, I think, equipped to be anxious in the animal kingdom. To worry and to think about all of the different possibilities, all of the different possible threats in the world. There was a study, you know, I clip these papers and then I don't read them. So I didn't read this for a whole year until I was going to give this talk. Title is, "For 80 years, young Americans have been getting more anxious and depressed, and no one is quite sure why." A lot of things have gotten better in the last 80 years. This study talks about that. There's more equality than there used to be. There's many, you know, many things that have improved our lives in the last 80 years. I don't think we should forget that. And the author of this study makes pains to make that point. But at the same time, kids, this is about children and young people, it's not just self-reported stress and anxiety, it's the symptoms of them that they were looking at here, because even though those words change over time, but can you sleep? Are you haunted by thoughts a lot of the time, or how much of the time? Things like that. Headaches, shortness of breath. It makes sense to me. You know, maybe it makes sense to you too. The pace of life has quickened over the last 80 years. We can do a lot more things than we used to be able to do. We have a lot more options. And I think in a way we pay for it. We don't get that for free. We have the ability to chase more things. And maybe also be chased by more things. You know, I think about yesterday we had a very nice workshop with Genko. Got me to thinking about my emails, you know. All of the emails that are chasing me, that didn't used to chase me. And the Buddha's prescription for this dukkha, for this unease, is to, in the second, the third noble truth, the cause, he says, is craving or desire, and the solution is to drop your craving, your desire. And I also think that this is a very good prescription. And it's what we do. It's our core practice. It's one of the things we do here in the Zen Center, to stop altogether, to stop wanting anything. So I actually prefer even desire to craving. It's even more blanket. Just stop wanting anything. For a time, then get back to wanting. But to interrupt our wanting altogether, to not desire to get something, not to desire to get away from anything for a time. This is zazen. This is our core practice. And it really is giving up our past and our future. It's giving up worrying about things. And getting to know and be comfortable with just this moment. As it is, exactly as it is. And then we, this break, it seems to me, is critical. It's important. It gives us the feeling, even if it's a short break, even if it's for 2 seconds, it lets us know that a break is possible. That life is not necessarily all about chasing and being chased. About getting and spending. And then we can go back to our life with, I believe, a certain different perspective. And to the extent that we remember that that's there, that that spot is there, that that aspect of ourselves that doesn't need to get anything, to the extent that we remember that that's there, I believe that is a great help to easing this unease, this very subtle irregularity in the axle. Yeah, so easily said, harder to do. Especially when we're feeling pressure from the future. Especially when we're feeling anxious. That's like the worst time to try to get rid of that. And one thing that Robert Wright in his book talks about is, you know, he talks about PowerPoint apocalypse anxiety when he's got to give a talk the next day and he can't sleep. And that he breaks that up, that anxiety, with intermissions of self-loathing at the sort of person who would worry so much about getting sleep that they can't sleep. So it's a kind of a loop. Maybe you know that loop. And he's comforted by the fact that the Buddha calls that one of the five. In some sutra, one of the five fears that we'll be embarrassed in front of the assembly. But what he suggests is to pick it up, to look at that anxiety, like that's the first step. And if something is really bothering me in zazen, I often do that. Sometimes I can just brush things away, but if something's really bothering me, I need to look at it. I need to get a little distance from it, rather than just be in it. Spinning, to get a little bit of distance from it, and turn it around in your hand, and question it. You know, is the world going to end if the PowerPoint breaks in the middle? Because I'm pretty sure, in a background kind of way, that it will. But if you bring that to the fore and ask yourself, well, is that going to happen? Is that so bad? You can get a little bit of distance and start to re-examine and have a different relationship with it, and it starts to break up this knot of future fear. I often use that. Sometimes what I do is I'll spin it out and just end up in the gutter under a bridge. And okay, then I'll start from there. It helps me to do that. Sometimes I have to think in order not to think. And all the while, breathing. All the while we do this practice, coming back as best we can, as even if it's very imperfectly, to this moment. Kenko gave a workshop, as I said yesterday, on the five invitations by Frank Ostasecki. They are: don't wait, welcome everything, bring your whole self to the experience, find a place of rest in the middle of things, and cultivate don't know mind. And that, I just want to pause for a moment on that last one, don't know mind. To the extent that we can find this don't know mind, we're okay for the time being. I don't know how the future, what's going to happen in the future. I'm quite convinced I do sometimes, especially when I catastrophize, but really I don't. And Genko has to do a little exercise where we listed times when we were pretty good at holding don't know mind and listed times when we weren't. And most of us came up with more examples of when we weren't, when we were so sure that this was going to be the outcome. You know, one that I'll just tell briefly, you know, which I mentioned yesterday was where Van Crozier came up with the idea to do Zen Jam, which is chanting and then world music coming in on top of the chanting and then dancing with wild abandon. And I told Leland as I left to go to that evening, I said, this is going to suck. I was just sure it was going to be really bad. And I went, and it was transformative. I couldn't believe how fun and exciting and wonderful it was. And I remember that. I remember Zen Jam. It comes to mind with some frequency. I call it to mind to remind myself that I don't know when I'm coming into a situation. Oh yeah, I don't know how it's going to go, really. And to the extent that I can walk into a situation with that, well, I don't know, mind, that's going into a situation with less anxiety. And of course, as we know, the truth is that usually leads to a better outcome because we're more open, we're ready. This article, young Americans have been getting more anxious and depressed, and no one's quite sure why. Jean Twenge, I don't know, maybe that's how you pronounce it, is the researcher from San Diego University. And I kind of went down, I didn't have much time, but I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole looking at her stuff. So they don't know why exactly, but she's got a couple of ideas. And one, she wrote another book called Generation Me, I think, is the name of it. The modern life has allowed us to explore more things and to, in a way, build ourself, individuate ourselves, choose from lots of different options. And that leads to more a kind of freedom. In Buddhist parlance, I would say it's a kind of freedom to crave all kinds of different things. that can lead to, that leads, I think, to a kind of problem around, we have more avenues for worry and anxiety. And it also allows us to separate from others more. We talk in Zen about becoming one with a moment, with this moment, and I think that is our core practice. But there's another aspect to Buddhism which I want to call your attention to. And that is that we do it together with other people. We do it in a sangha. We do it not as individuals exactly. We are individuals, of course, but we do it together as a sangha. And one of the worries that I have, I think it's great that more people are meditating. I really do. On balance, it's a very good thing. It's just that when you're doing it, with your iPhone, with an app, there is a distinct difference from doing it with people. And that there are subtle things that doing it with people give you. And one of the things, I think, is real connection with others. To me, that's very important. And in this study, she hypothesizes that, modern life, she says, doesn't give us as many opportunities to spend time with people and connect with them face to face, in person, like it was 80 years ago or 100 years ago. And things like families and groups of people are less important, like actual, joining a group. I don't mean this to be an advertisement for joining this group per se, but I do think that aspect can be overlooked, and not just by culture in general, but also in Buddhism too. I sometimes think about that and worry a little bit about it. I do feel that the human interaction is something that I'm not sure exactly how it works, but it feels to me like it's a kind of, just in relation to anxiety, it gives us a kind of perspective, a different perspective. It's not just us in the world all by myself. We're together with other people who know us. And in a certain way, and this is true of a healthy family, accept us as we are. And I feel that that is a very important part of practice. It's something we learn when we do Zazen, that this moment will accept us. I think that is something I have learned, that it's okay, that I'm okay with all my faults. But I think a group of people that have that same orientation also give us that and can help with many things, including a kind of perspective. A kind of perspective that helps with, helps us get through our anxious times, our times of worry, our times of which it looks like the future is bleak. So I think that our practice, our core practice of letting everything go, letting all of our desires go for a time, and then coming back to ourselves, letting go of past and of future, is a great aid in modern life. That's kind of the Buddha aspect. But I also feel that this community, this flesh and blood community of Sangha, is another great aid for us as we go forward into the future.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.